I'm Robert Alds, the director of the Bruges Group, which is a long-standing Eurosceptic, pro-freedom, pro-nation state, pro-sovereignty organisation that was originally founded following a speech by Margaret Thatcher, who was our founder president.
Could you say something about the early days of the proposed EEC? Because I understand that Britain was taken into it by Edward Heath without, this is the European Economic Community, the forerunner to the EU, without actually any vote taking place.
Absolutely. Yeah, Britain was taken into the EEC, which eventually became the European Union, which Britain left, essentially the same organisation, just greater degrees of centralisation and further institutional skullduggery and development, which had led the EEC, the European Economic Community, to become the European Union. Edward Heath didn't say he was going to join. He's going to have negotiations to join, but there was no referendum on Britain joining the common market, as it was incorrectly called at the time, or colloquially called at the time, which it never was a common market. It always was about centralization. It was always about taking freedom from the nation states and giving that power to an unaccountable elite, a technocratic elite, self-serving elite based in Brussels and the institutions of the EEC, later the European Community, and of course, ultimately the European Union, which still remains just about.
Yeah, well, the thing is, back in the day, this wasn't a left-right issue. It wasn't something, although it was, of course, the Conservative Party that carried us in with pressure from Nigel Farage into having a referendum about this. People like Peter Shaw, Tony Benn in the Labour Party were concerned, weren't they, about the idea of handing sovereignty away. So what changed? The left is seems to be, so busy embracing the European Union, despite the effect, for example, on pay and conditions and on the unions.
Indeed, it was a time when the labour movement was a patriotic movement. There was a firm link between democracy and the nation state. People being proud of their country and knew that democracy and control of the government via the ballot box and free and fair elections and underpinned by freedom of speech was a way of using the strength of the state and the arms of the state and using the economy in a way that would it seemingly benefit working people. So then when we could use the terms of left and right, there was a meaning there. And the European Union, in a sense, was a project to suppress that, to suppress national identities, to open up markets, which may or may not have benefits, get rid of nationalized industries. It was very much a corporatist project that enabled elites to prosper, and they most certainly have. And there was a time when the Labour Party was, of course, patriotic. We can think back to a Labour leader in the 1960s, Hugh Gaitskell, who spoke of joining the EEC as the end of 1,000 years of British history. That was sort of emotive language, but it's all very, very true and correct. The Labour Party was not against the nation state, whereas some people in the Conservative Party at the time were quite happy to go into the European Union as it became and have ever closer union and have a take part in this corporatist project. But now, of course, left and right, they are terms I don't think they really have much meaning other than to give a sham of democracy, give some pretense that elections will actually change anything. We have concepts of the uni party and a great amorphous mass of politicians which aren't really going to do anything radically different. It may just be changes in tone and what about and more concerned with what's being said rather than what's being done. But now I see the Labour Party is very much about being anti-working class people, which in a sense socialism always was. It always was about keeping the common man in his box, dependent upon the state and thoroughly controlled economically and socially by that. Whereas other some politicians have wanted to set people free to make their own decisions, make
Well,
their own
okay. So, I
choices
mean, I'm sure
economically.
some left-wing people would disagree with that, being that the socialists are much more interested in having infrastructure in the country, such as things like gas, water. The obvious one, of course, is transport. There are many of these institutions that the left points out that if they're not in public hands, then there isn't all that much point in voting. You're not going to be able to change. But anyway, look, we're here
Yeah,
today. Sorry, go on.
of course. Of course, Adam Smith, one of the leading lights of free market, the Scottish moral philosopher, and now seen today largely as an economist, wouldn't have disagreed. He would have said, well, there can be a public good in terms of providing infrastructure, water, rail, roads, particularly roads at the time he was writing, and now he would have recognised that. So that's not particularly radical, but controlling the means of production, distribution, and exchange is possibly a step beyond what any party thinks of. So the Labour Party's long given up this veneer of socialism. Some people would have been passionate about the condition of the working class. Other people, from Lenin, who despised working class people, or and their ways, and Marx, and not, of course, they weren't socialists as we understand it. And people like George Orwell was, of course, a socialist, but a patriotic one at the same time, and warned about the extremities of any ideology, really. But that one in particular. But the Labour Party's long given up being socialist, and it's more about contempt for working class people. It's more about more migrants and more benefits, which having a benefits culture is absolutely antithetical to socialism or various left-wing ideology, where it wouldn't be tolerated someone not having a job, not being productive. A job would be found for you. Giving more benefits to people is not a suitable economic policy that the left would have previously tolerated or thought it was a
No, they were
good
doing their
solution.
best to make sure that the economy was actually functioning to provide jobs, as were the right back in those days. I mean, in fact, gigantic things like massive public house building programs, which put lots of people to work. But anyway, we're here to
Well,
talk
yeah, which was begun
about
largely by the Conservatives, and so there was a crossover, but now we have politicians which serve a corporate interest, and the profit margins of those right at the very top, and that's what the Labour Party is concerned about, and many other parties as well, may I add.
So anyway, we're here to talk about Rodney Atkinson, who sadly passed away last week. There are several figures who have been very important in the understanding of the evils, if I can use that word, and the skullduggery involved in selling out national sovereignty to Brussels over the decades. Christopher Story is another one. Some fascinating figures who really did a lot of research. But of course, these people were effectively cancelled by the entire establishment, including most of the media. Can you just give us an idea of what you think Rodney's contribution has been?
Yes, certainly. Rodney Atkinson, he was a brilliant man. He was an extensive author of a great many political pamphlets going back to the 1980s. But with the ever encroachment of the European Union, which was and is and remains a project, of course, which is an ever present danger, because the Starmer regime is pushing us closer into the EU. where we're effectively being run, out of Europe, but still run by Europe. Rodney was someone who warned about the dangers. He was concerned with people's freedom, their liberty, and of course the national sovereignty of the country. And he was very powerful in terms of the development of what people were thinking. He wrote or co-authored books with Norris McWhirter about treason at Maastricht. He had warned about the threat to our sovereignty with the Maastricht Treaty, which was the treaty which really did turn the European Economic Community into a structure that took far more power over the nation states, which has been a disaster for many people in the UK
I think
and of
it was
course the
fair
UK
to say
and of
that
course on the
this
continent as
pamphlet,
well.
Treason at Maastricht, was one of the most, I mean, it's where anyone that was wanting to know more, a journalist or anybody else, about what was going on with the Maastricht Treaty, which was the one of the first stages in the actual creation of the European Political Union, as regards as beyond an economic union. Treason at Maastricht may have been the first time many people came across Rodney.
Yeah, indeed. Other people in the political world would have certainly known of him and his writings and his work and his activism, but he really did spread the word. And this was a time, in a sense, like in many political movements, they sort of go corporate. The dedicated followers of fashion get involved when there's big money donors. Then people set up campaigns with fancy offices and large budgets, and politicos get involved and cream the benefits off. No doubt believing in the cause they're fighting. Rodney was someone who was very different. He started when it was little known. He was, in a sense, there was a number of lone people who were just very active. There were some lone politicians, Christopher Gill, for instance, who didn't like what was happening, and many other politicians. In a sense, too many to recognize to name now, but all have had their part to play, and been very influential in developing thought in this country and warning of the dangers. And the British people, I think, were instinctively opposed to what was happening with the European. They didn't pass the smell test, and Rodney was very influential in explaining those concerns, putting them into words, and exposing what the European Union was all about, and teaming up with people such as Norris McWhirter. There's a whole host of other people as well who were just campaigning out of their own pocket, researching, writing, spreading the word because they passionately believed in the cause. There was other people, you may have known Idris Francis, who of course would travel from event to event and ask difficult questions of politicians and expose their hypocrisy and point out where they're lying about Europe. And Rodney Atkinson was using his, undoubtedly very strong intellect and persuasive writing and articulate nature to help spread that word and really helped get the cause going, a cause which is ultimately triumphant in the 2016 referendum, which, 10 years ago now, which you referred to. But of course, we're yet to have the full Brexit that we're actually promised.
Yes, well, I mean, that's the sort of fly in the ointment here, isn't it? That we've had this referendum, voted for Brexit, but what's really changed, Robert?
Well, there are a number of there are many not many benefits that have happened. The Bruges Group has the organization that I run, we've published a book, 75 Brexit Benefits. There's 75, there's actually a few more tangible real benefits that we've had from exiting the European Union. Some people may disagree with the policy choices of the government, but there have been some important things, and there's one very relevant one as well at this point in time, which is access to aviation fuel outside of the European Union. Britain's airlines can access it cheaper and more easily. That's something, the latest thing that's emerged. There's many different benefits that have come. So there are tangible, real opportunity we've taken advantage of, but we could do much more. And the sovereignty, because this is what Rodney was particularly concerned about, parliamentary sovereignty, and which is how we exercise democracy in this country, was absolutely vital. He didn't have an axe to grind in policy matters when it came to Europe, other than the making the people free and not subject to tyranny. And tyranny is a very strong word, but when we have 12,000 people a year convicted for speech and thought crimes, there is a very real tyranny. And Rodney, of course, was less well in the last year of his life, and it's very sad his passing. He must have been absolutely aghast at what's happened and how the political elites are amassing power to suppress freedom, because that's what Rodney ultimately believed in. He believed in the freedom of British people, British men and women, to make their own choices and live their lives as they saw fit, without an overbearing executive, particularly one in a foreign nation, the European Union, governing us and telling us what to do.
One of my lasting memories of Rodney's work is he spurred me on to look into this idea that Walter Funk, who was he was the head of the Reichsbank during the Second World War, the Nazi boss, had come up with this idea in 1941 called the Europäische Wirtschaftsgemeinschaft in order to run occupied Europe economically, and that this was actually almost like a blueprint, really, for the European Political Union. Now, this is a pretty shocking concept that the Brussels EU is actually based on the Nazi finance ministry and the Reichsbank back in the 1941, just as the Nazis were invading and occupying Norway, Belgium, the Netherlands, etc. So this is a little bit of I wonder what you make of that. If you think that really stands up, that one.
Yes, this was actually instituted in 1942, and the German that you spoke is often translated as European Economic Society. Of course, it equally translates as European into English as European Economic Community. This idea of a centralized Europe, it wasn't new. It has historical precedents that go back in time, and different ideologies, particularly intolerant ideologies, which mainly come from the continent of Europe. Communism, fascism, Nazism, they come from continental Europe. There's very little to be had that's beneficial from the continental Europe, other than perhaps their food produce. But dare I say it, English sparkling wine beats actually French champagne in blind taste tests.
Oh,
I'll
hang
just
on a
leave
minute. Oh,
that.
does it? Okay. I mean,
Absolutely.
that's.
I'll just leave that to one side. That's
Yeah. I mean, also, of course, we've.
but the point being is yeah, it absolutely, Rodney was absolutely right, and he saw that the European Union had fascist origins, as he called it, and was wanted to warn people about this very real threat to our freedom. And the European Union is just that, and remains that to this day. Of course, the thing is, there's our own politicians as well, Europhile politicians, who are just as big a threat to our liberty as them. Of course, it's a different idea. It has different ideological elements. We can't say that people in the European Union are actually Nazis, as we would have understood. That's because they were thoroughly defeated and got rid of that regime. Was for the most part, thoroughly liquidated as a result of largely, I think, British resistance during the Second World War. Another internal,
Well, not the Russians.
well, the Russians, who were thoroughly dependent upon British and American aid. So we're empowered. The trucks they got, the aviation fuel, the Russians got. Of course, they made a great sacrifice, but this. There was a whole lot of help from us, and the air crews who leveled German industry and kept that down. You know, it was a campaign of many different angles. But we should never forget Britain's involvement when Britain was a martial country and willing to stand up for itself and actually had a functioning and patriotic armed forces. Whereas I wouldn't necessarily trust the top brass in the armed forces now. The top, the individual squad is various troopers and soldiers would be no doubt the patriotic salt of the earth, but I don't think we can trust the Ministry of Defence to be defending our
Well, no,
freedoms,
but you see,
even if they were capable.
this is interesting. We've had just like this week the resignation of the Defence Secretary. I mean, this is obviously he is looking at the main chance with someone like Andy Burnham potentially taking over. He wants a job in that new cabinet, so it's a bit maybe a cynical move. But let's just point out here that this is the Ministry of Defence which is the problem. The armed forces themselves have to go cap in hand to the Ministry of Defence, who then have to go cap in hand to the Treasury. So this is why we are in the situation where we don't have any operating submarines, apparently, we hear this week, and the country is unable really to say it is a strong has a strong defence. I'd also like to just add on this idea of the Walter Funk and his Europäischen Wirtschaftsgemeinschaft, is he talked about regionalizing. So he wanted to reduce the power of France, and he did, in fact, in occupied France by regionalizing it, by setting up these sort of regional parliament type organizations with Gauleiters. They weren't really parliament, elected parliaments, but they had the German guard, in other words, to regionalize. And this is exactly what Tony Blair ended up doing by setting up a Welsh Parliament and a Scottish Parliament around about, I think it was the year 2000 or 2001. So I wonder if Blair even realized that he's actually following, potentially anyway, a Nazi plan when he did that.
These ideas have long held roots, deep roots that go back in time, and different ideologies pick them up, dust them off for their own ends. But the idea of regionalization, of course, has been advocated by people that want to see the end of the nation state. They want to separate us from our roots, separate us from our traditions, cultures, and identities, make us one amorphous mass of consumers at the whim of corporations that and they just think that we'll put up with being owning nothing and being happy. Well, we're not going. Well, people aren't happy with this situation and the mass migration and the Germans during the Second World War were very, very in favor of bringing in labor from other nations to work within their industries. Cheap labor, of course, they use slave labor. The idea of bringing in cheap labor from abroad is an idea which is very prevalent in Germany to this day, but something which is ruining their social fabric and causing a great deal of problems in that country and political tensions just as it is within the UK. It's the elites that are the problem, that don't want a competitive, functioning free market with people free to innovate and choose. Want people kept in their place, and at the whim of the powerful. That's actually always been human nature, but it's our job as Englishmen to resist that, and that has been our cultural traditions, that no one should be above the law. And the state should be working in our interests and our own rights to private property and protect our own castle, so to speak, and our own freedom is something that's deeply ingrained and has Anglo-Saxon origins and is something that the Bruges Group is very keen to spread and make that known. We must resist this shift towards ever more tyranny, be that tyranny from the European Union or tyranny from our own government.
Did you ever meet Rodney?
Oh, very, very, yeah,
Well,
many
I just
times.
wonder if you've got any memories you can share of him.
Well, yes, we've had dinner, we've attended conferences together, we'd spoke together at political events in all manner of parts of the country. He was charming, erudite, well spoken, and very nice gentleman. He was very keen for the Bruges Group to support his many campaigns, the South Molton Declaration, or the when and the Declaration of British Independence, where he wanted politicians to sign up and commit to supporting Britain's sovereignty and a free and fair referendum, so that we can be a self-governing country again, not under the control of a foreign bureaucracy or foreign courts for that matter. And this was absolutely crucial to him. That was he was a very caring man, and charming fellow, and someone that had gone a long way in spreading the word. And I was pleased to know him and liked him. He'd fallen out with some political people, namely Nigel Farage and the later departed Christopher Booker. He blamed them for him not achieving the leadership of the United Kingdom Independence Party. But he didn't stop his work. He continued.
There is quite a lot online that says that McWhirter and Rodney Atkinson were really and part of the Freedom Association. This is what is fascism. They are the real fascists, the far right. What do you have to say to that?
Well, people that talk about freedom, that there's somewhat of an inversion. It's sort of quite funny that people would call a man who wanted to have democracy and freedom and people making their own choices, that's somehow fascist. That's sort of quite absurd. Fascism is an economic and political structure where corporatism prevails, where private industry and private enterprise is allowed. It's only allowed so long as that's in the service of the state, and decisions are made at a corporate level by elites, behind closed doors, but making decisions on behalf of people. If you want to look at what people often misassociate fascism with Nazism, two very different ideologies. But if you want to look at a sort of fascist economic model, you're probably better looking at current arrangements of the of Britain in this day, when we have a massive amount of massive tax burden, which largely goes towards a very significant part goes towards welfare, but a very large part goes towards public services, who buy and procure services from private industry. A very large part of the economy, which is in a sense of the private economy, is at the service of the state. That's something that Rodney would have did absolutely object to. He wanted people to making their own decisions, and the other side just use slur words, because they can't win arguments. Rodney would point out the facts of what the European Union is and what it's done, and his fears about what it could indeed become. And their response is to probably one of they're it's the phenomenon where people will insult someone, but the insult actually refers more to the person using the word than the person who is actually the victim of their insults. It's really sort of quite absurd that some people would use that term when they support a system which is made us less free and less democratic, and people across Europe would just love to break out from the European Union. Macron himself, the president of France, had said he would never allow a referendum in France on French membership of the EU because people would vote to leave. That's in France. People don't want this. They don't want to be governed by elites, and events and the Epstein files tell us so much that decisions are made increasingly by people at the top who have more in common with each other, Davos, the World Economic Forum, and so forth, than their own national electorates. And Keir Starmer, Sir Keir Starmer, British Prime Minister, was asked, "What do you prefer, Westminster or Davos?" He said, "Davos." He prefers a foreign meeting of technocrats, of industrialists, oligarchs, and other politicians and other unaccountable people to the institutions of his own country that British people had fought, particularly people within the labor movement had fought to expand the power of those institutions. That's what we're dealing with. And Rodney would, of course, was absolutely appalled with that and wanted to make sure the British people were sovereign. And that's the freedom which we still hope to achieve.
Well, look, you've been at this a few years, Robert. I wonder if you could just give us a brief summary of where you think we're at with these nationalist anti-EU parties, such as Reform UK, Restore Britain, and your own Bruges group. Whereabouts is it at these days?
Well, the Bruges group's not a political party. We're there to promote the intellectual case for an independent UK, and also we've done a lot recently about warning about climate change, the climate change hysteria, may I add, and the excuse me, the scam which is surrounding climate hysteria. We've also promoting various books that promote the idea of Brexit, how that must be defended, and also celebrate the history of this country, and we're publishing a book very, very shortly, coming out on Monday, which is the anniversary of Magna Carta being signed, that would be celebrating the culture of this country, which goes back to Anglo-Saxon times, which was about people rather than power and privilege.
Yeah, but we're in the situation with Nigel Farage's Reform UK. Back in March, it was quite interesting to see that one of the polls suggested he would, in the present position, be able to get a decent parliamentary majority. So are you celebrating that?
Well, that would be preferable to a Labour government, or what is possibly, I still think there is a very high chance of the next election will be dominated, will produce a parliament where there may be a majority, well, not a majority for any particular party, but there's the danger that the Labour, Liberal Democrats, and the Greens would manage to put together some rainbow coalition and continue the destruction of this country through the demographic disaster which is unfolding before our very, very eyes. And there we the economic system that we have, which I sort of detail in a book that I've just completed called The Biorealist Manifesto, is one where it's I characterized it as being feminized rather than a masculine productive economy. We have an economy based on process. We have an economy based on entitlement rather than production and outcomes, and that is part of the problem. That's one reason why the country is borrowing so much when debt to GDP is not too far off 100%, mid-90s, but it's predicted to go up to 3 trillion by 2030. 3 trillion of debt. That's just government debt. That doesn't include the current debts. The the problems are so severe that there is a danger that they will only worsen under a Labour, Liberal Democrat, Green coalition with the Scottish Nationalists voting with them. That we're in a situation where party politics can't just be the answer to our problems. The problems are so severe, they're not going to be solved without the inevitable sort of crash that is coming, and people feel that the IMF may indeed be called in. But the demographic problems, the social problems that we're facing are very severe. And it's not Nigel Farage's politics to be, he's just not, it's just not his politics that he would be deporting people. He's made that clear. He was aghast at the UKIP of Gerard Batten, who was a member of the European Parliament, who for a time, amongst others, became the leader of UKIP after the United Kingdom Independence Party after the referendum, and had a sort of policy about or campaigned about warning about the Islamification of Britain. And Nigel Farage found, he's a man who is very much live and let live, and doesn't that's not his politics. So he won't be seeking to solve those problems, because that's not something that motivates him. He's concerned about being able to be free to live his life, and wants other people to live theirs as they wish. He wouldn't be dealing with issues to do with the power of Islam within the country, as Rupert Lowe of Restore Britain would. But unfortunately, it seems that we have many. It is the nature of people who are concerned with freedom in this country and our own cultural traditions, that there's less ability to unite. So we can be splitting the vote between Conservatives, Restore UK, Reform, and a myriad of other smaller parties who share sort of similar aims. We need to make a decision. Of course, a government led by Nigel Farage and Reform would certainly be preferable to what we have. But we'll only be buying a few more years for this country and for our civilization. It'll give us a bit of breathing space. The option of having Labour win the next election would be a disaster. So really, everything needs to be focused on making sure that we don't have this crazy rainbow coalition where the floodgates are opened and the printing presses are just producing more funny money that enriches those at the top, but beggars the rest of us through inflation and ever higher cost of living. We need to we need to stop Labour sooner than later, and their allies, and we need a cultural and economic change which would make the country productive again and actually producing things. We need education that would focus on STEM subjects rather than the humanities. We're not going to be able to keep on borrowing forever. It just can't happen. At some point, we're going to be facing a crunch, and that crunch could be coming sooner rather than later.
Look, finally, you talking about Islam. For me, Christianity and Islam have actually got a tremendous amount in common in terms of actual morality, which we're drifting fast away from. And I wonder whether the digs that people seem to be having at Islam are really actually more to do with support for the Israelis and the Zionist lobby.
Well, I think there's two different things there. Certainly, people speculate that the various sort of pro-Zionist interests want to whip up hatred towards Muslims. But then, we have to deal with the demographic issues facing this country. That's a very real thing. There, of course, a lot can be learned from many of the migrant communities in the UK, because they practice what I call biorealism, whereas we don't. We've suppressed the and propagated the belief that print in and which has rested largely on the feminization of corporate life away from a hierarchical, productive, dynamic culture to one where not much get not much essentially gets done. And I think that's a fair assessment of the British economy. That's one reason why our infrastructure's failing. That's one reason why the MOD's failing. Everything's become about process rather than what the actual outcomes are. And of course the demographic problems that we face, which we're facing a collapse in our population numbers, and that we one may wish to celebrate migrants within the UK and think, okay, well they will integrate and assimilate. That will only work so long as there is a culture in which they can integrate and assimilate into. If the numbers are so great and the demographic crash of the population, the indigenous heritage peoples of these islands reduces to such an extent that there's just so few of us left, then there's not going to be a culture that they can assimilate and integrate into. And Britain within a generation will be fundamentally different. And the culture that's created liberty, spread liberty around the world to even peoples that didn't necessarily want it, and unable to action it, and institutions and built cities where there was nothing but desert or savannah, and taken the ideas of representative government, of liberty and freedom of speech, private property, equality before the law, taking that around the world. If that ceases to exist in the very homeland where that was created, that's absolutely a disaster. And no doubt we should certainly learn from those migrant communities that do have growing populations. And what are they doing differently? What are they doing, in a sense, doing better? Because if society is not reproducing itself, then something's going very, very wrong. And I say that when we have a situation where there's a recent report by the Centre for Social Justice, written by Alan Milburn, a former Blairite cabinet member, National Union of Miners trade union official, warning that for every job given to a native British person, 20 a young native British person, 22 go to someone of a migrant background, then something's going very, very wrong. And we have to address this. I want my civilization to continue, and
Well,
it will be to the detriment of everybody in this land, be they Christian, Muslim, or whatever, if this greatest civilization on earth ceases to exist, essentially in a generation or two, because of mass migration, but ultimately because of the demographic problems that we face, because of the economy, which is unproductive and doesn't give opportunities for men to provide for their families.
yeah, well, this is, I think, you know what? I think many existing migrants in this country, maybe people that came to Britain, families in the 1960s, 70s, 80s, etc., would agree with you. They do see themselves as British, but they see that something has gone too far with migrant labour being simply economic migrants who are here just to provide cheap labour. Anyway, I'm just going to run through finally a list of a few of his latest pamphlets that Rodney produced to give people a bit of an idea of what he was doing. There was one called The Emancipated Society and the Fascist Origins of the EU. It's two lectures. Brexit, Necessary for Saving Democracy and Stopping War. He did that article for RT back in 2016. Theresa May's Irish Myth Blows Up Brexit. So this is some of the problems that were caused with the saying that if you have a border between North and Southern Ireland, that the troubles will return. Can the UK learn from Russia? Interesting. That was in 2018. Germany profits as Greece collapses. Another look at the dynamics going on within the economic European Union and the Euro zone. Theresa May's Brexit surrender. And finally, the final pamphlet was or article was The Benefits of a True Brexit, published in the British Church newspaper on the 15th of March 2019. And if anyone wants to get to know Rodney's key message, there's an excellent video out there called Brexit or Die, which is actually a very detailed, I suppose, academic look really at just how undemocratic and anti-democratic the Brussels EU is. Anyway, Robert, I wonder if you could just wind up by letting people know whereabouts to find out about the Bruges Group, whereabouts to find and follow you, and if you've got any events coming up.
Yes, certainly. Well, we have an event coming up this Wednesday, which I will be publishing, where we're launching our book, which details, amongst other things, the power, the people power, and privilege, a concise history of England and our struggles for freedom. Essentially, they can find out about a lot of what I've spoken about, which is in a book titled "The Biorealist Manifesto: The Economic Costs of Feminizing Society and How to Restore Prosperity." A lot of what I've sort of spoke about there, and our intolerant nature that exists from the state that cracks down on freedom of speech, is in itself a result of feminization, and how people now are less willing to stand up for their freedom and allow the government to take liberties with our freedom, shall I say. But a lot more can be found online and on across all social media platforms under the Bruges Group. So Bruges Group, Bruges Group. Find us on X, Facebook, and of course our website. But I urge readers, listeners rather, to go and get a copy, read the book, The Biorealist Manifesto, which will be available from all good booksellers, and that will warn about the tyranny that we're facing because of essentially the feminization of our economy and society, and the problems that's caused. But a final word is that Rodney Atkinson was clearly a dedicated patriot, a patriotic man, a man who wanted the best for his country and everyone within it, and for people to be to for, to be free, and that's to be absolutely lauded. And we could do with many more Rodneys now.
Yeah, and it's so important to be able to get rid of bad rulers. And when you've got a whole bunch of bad rulers are the only ones that are standing for election, that makes things rather difficult.
Indeed, that's the key thing. It's sovereignty is something that needs to be exercised, practiced, and people need to be held to account. And a lot has been done to our country in the name of, well, in the name of corporatist interests, and it's left this country in a parlous state. It's left Northern Ireland burning, and many people in the Republic already also standing up to mass immigration, because they want to essentially preserve their society and their opportunities for their young people. They're taking the wrong path, but that's in a sense an inevitable, predictable consequence of a situation where corporate interests want more and more cheap labour, but also It's also a failing social and economic system where our indigenous population is unfortunately declining, and this is an emergency we cannot speak enough about, and we need to find answers to that. And I believe the answer is one of economic change, where we have production and what I to a sort of more masculine economy, where we can actually start making things in this country again.
Well, this is what Michael Hudson would call a industrial capitalism, not, rather than finance capitalism, which is what's dominating now, turning everything into a pound sign and a dollar sign, people going to work every day in an office and not apparently achieving anything. But anyway, look, it's been fascinating. Robert Olds from the Bruges Group, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony.